Welcome back to Karl Marx Ate My Field Notes. This is Edgar Rivera Colon, or Rivera Colon, and I think we're on episode 5 already, which is sort of amazing on our podcast. I'm hoping everyone's having a good Monday. I'm actually going to be recording this a little later than usual. I usually do it during the weekends. So last time we were talking about a bunch of stuff. We talked about hegemony. We talked about all kinds of things around love, and we ended with the idea of radical political virtue. Part of that idea is that virtue. No one's born virtuous. No child comes into the world virtuous. They may come in innocent, unsocialized, incapable of taking care of themselves. They actually are incapable. But slowly, they learn the virtues. And that's because they observe. People teach them. And slowly, they become gifted in language, as most children do. And it's through language and culture and institutions and socializations and basically habits that are formed through the communities they're part of, the traditions that they're part of, their kinship networks, the institutions they interact with, and eventual realization that most children have that there is actually pleasure outside the family, that there's a world outside the family, right? The great leap into quote-unquote society, although we all know that the family is a social institution, so they were already in society. So these habits have to be formed. And I think what's happened in the U.S. is there's been such a focus on money and power and sex, not in its liberative form, but rather in its very restricted sort of heterosexist utility form as a commodity, really, that we've not learned as well as we should what it means to be part of a community of reflection and social practice that allows us to develop the habits or virtues that we would need to create this kind of human flourishing I've been talking about, this community of human flourishing. As I've already said, capitalism really doesn't tolerate that. It's the antithesis of it. It narrows people. It restricts their imagination. So on many levels, what we're struggling with today is a emptiness around community, around the ability to build these conversations and practices and interventions in the world, action, because that's what it's about, action in the world. And not having that community of people which you can have a dialogue. And I think that that's one thing that we're missing. And as a result, we see a society that's in certain ways consuming itself, cannibalizing itself. And it's really the market, the mechanism of the market allied with the state, which has really been captured by the corporations, propelling this forward. You know, so even just a straightforward Marxist analysis would get you at least more than halfway there when you see what's happening in the country. And then you have to understand as fundamental the question of racism, the question of sexism, the question of heteropatriarchy. And a lot of people see that as buzz terms, as identity politics of some sort. They're mistaken. They're mistaken on many levels. People come to consciousness politically through their identities. And those identities can serve all kinds of purposes. They can serve very conservative purposes, or they can serve radical purposes. It's really integrating them into a wider analysis of the crisis we're living in. So what is virtue? Or more importantly, what does virtue do? And I think that's the question that we should be asking. Instead of looking for some kind of theory in the sky, what can virtue do for us? And here again, it's not an individual thing. Just like the soul is not an individual thing. It is about being part of a community of people who are struggling for something like freedom, like becoming human, becoming full integrated humans. And I'm going to sort of make a quote or share a quote with you from a very ancient text as well. And quote, when we say that virtue is the order or the ordering of love, we refer to the end to which virtue is ordered. Because in us, love is set in order by virtue. So this ancient text talks about the connection between how virtue orders our love. It focuses it. And it's in love that we can because in us, love is set in order by virtue. So it's this connection between order, love, and virtue. So ordering love, what does that mean? That means that we order it towards its end. And what is that end? Again, we go back to this question of human flourishing, of the capacities of people to realize themselves as people. And I think one of the blocks to that has been a society devoted to a narrow sense of the individual. Not a social individual, but a restricted, marketized, commodified individual. And I'll tell you a story that might help with this. It's a great thing to have a capacity to teach. And it's a great thing to have the capacity to learn. I once taught at a very elite school in the public health realm. And I was at a faculty meeting one day, and this was the first year I was teaching, I remember. I did research, and then I taught and combined the two. And this one person who had not yet gotten tenure, but would get tenure, she said, Edgar, the students love you. They think you're a great teacher. And then she looked at me and said, that's lethal for your career. And she was being dead serious. Now, this person in particular was not a person that was tremendously well-liked in the department. She was selfish and came from a very privileged class background, but she understood something quite well, that the university was not, at least that university, was not geared towards teaching, and that you shouldn't waste so much time teaching when you can, what you really need to do is focus on your research so you can get money to have grants, to make money, to do research, to make more money, to get grants, right? So most people probably don't know about that part of university life. I think the person who said it was just being frank with me. I took it as a joke, but later on I realized that she was being dead serious, and her emphasis on not focusing on students reflected the values, the distorted values of the university, which is primarily in this instance, in the place I was teaching, a research institution where teaching is something that people have to do. They may like it or may not. It pays the bills. But if they want to be successful, they have to get their own research grants and make projects and research and follow where the grants are going, and basically write studies that most people will never read. You know, a few of them come through and wind up in the media and people learn something, but most of them are really for other experts to look at, not for the broad public. They have, from what I can tell, no civic consciousness and no real common good in the sense of a shared good. So that's one story, right? So in that case, virtue could not order the love of knowledge because the love of knowledge had been subordinated to this machine, basically a research machine. And I think that we see that all over in the professions. And we see this as a general thing in the society, that the professions are in a crisis. The whole society is in what Jürgen Habermas would call a legitimation crisis. That it can no longer convince people that it's authentic or real or the best possible system. And we see this in the Trumpian moment. Trump is interesting for many reasons. My sense is what Trump has done is open up the curtains and shown what kind of a opportunistic, careerist, power-hungry, money-hungry operation DC is, Washington, DC, and the ruling elites and the corporate lobbyists who basically manipulate them, what that is. I think most of us knew that, but Trump sort of puts it in your face. The other thing that Trump does, and this is totally unintentional on his part, is to expose the idealization, and I mean that in not ideal, I mean IDOL in the old like Jewish Bible sense of an idol that is not God, a golden, you know, calf or something. Americans have this fascination with the presidency, that someone, if they're a president, you're supposed to say, sir, you're supposed to bow down to them somehow. Maybe it's because we have no blood aristocracy in the United States. We have a money aristocracy. And the presidential office is supposed to be held high. The fact of the matter is that most 20th century American presidents are probably war criminals, probably engaged in all kinds of thievery and thuggery before they become president. And then they take on the mantle of the presidency and the dignity of the office, they call it. I'm suspicious of that. It sounds like idolatry to me. The reality is that we should have a much more sober assessment of what a president can do and what a president is. Being president is not probably the biggest recommender that you have ordered your life through virtue and love. It's usually you have ordered your life to power and money. So I think one of the good things, and again, not intentionally, of the Trumpian or Trumpism era that we're living in, is that people are beginning to understand that the whole system is corrupt, that even reforming the system will also maintain the corruption. We can see that beginning in the Democratic Party now. We see that the media, and here we're talking about MSNBC, CNN, Fox, have decided there are three candidates, really, in their running. Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Joe Biden. And I have a feeling that the moneyed classes on Wall Street are a little nervous about Joe Biden, although they think he can win. And they're hedging their bets and moving some of their money to Warren, because Warren is someone who has enough elite credentials and that they're able to manipulate her, or at least, okay, if Trump's gonna get beaten, at least we'll have someone we can negotiate with, even if she wants reform. Whereas Sanders, they know they won't be able to negotiate as much. So I think the elite, the monies of the elites are moving towards Warren just in case Biden doesn't work out and he sticks his foot in his mouth again. Now be aware, all the candidates are 70 years old, right? And whether they can mobilize the young is another question. I think the only one who can probably are Warren or Sanders, and actually the one who I think might lead the society to a point of less crisis would be Sanders himself. But the money's not on him. The Wall Street money doesn't feel he's loyal to them. And that might be a problem for him. So we'll see what the Democrats do. But I mean, it's really an election for their winning. But again, they're quite studied in the ability to lose. Now, one of the things I guess I want to talk about today, along with this question of radical political virtue, is what would be the circumstances for it? It would be a question of gathering people into circles of support, of clarification, of dialogue that leads to radical action. Within the purview of the society we're living in today, there has to be ways to protest, to stop the machine through civil disobedience, through disruptions of various kinds. We haven't gotten there yet. There's groups of people doing all kinds of things that are great, but it hasn't jumped to a mass level yet. And I don't know what would produce that jump yet. And it just, maybe we don't have the political infrastructure for it right now, although I see signs of it being built on a national level. So we'll see. It could be a number of things. It could be a climate disaster that polarizes the society or catalyzes the kind of changes that we need. So we're waiting for that. But in the meanwhile, we can continue to ask, What are the virtues we need to create a more just society? What are the things I'm committed to? Who do I connect with to clarify this so I'm just not on my own? And this question of love, right? And love is not sentiment. Sentiment is Hallmark cards. Mm-hmm. Sentiment is the script from a soap opera. Love is work and a fidelity to the other, their happiness, and also a commitment to build the material and spiritual resources to create a society for the common good, a revolutionary society in that sense, right? Go back to that Grace Lee Boggs, that wonderful saying, growing our souls. Now, how do we do this is going to be a difficult thing to explain. I think we'll have to do it before we can explain it. But I do want to take a little turn here and think about how do you build things in a period or time where it doesn't seem that there are absolute signs that it, you know, we're going to pull it off, right? And I'm reading a book by Adam Phillips, who's a child psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst, and he's quoting someone in his book, Jeffrey Hartman. And basically Hartman says, open quotes, "The clearest sign of a truly creative, self-renewing mind is to build up greatest things from least suggestions." Let me say it again. "The clearest sign of a truly creative, self-renewing mind is to build up greatest things from least suggestions." So what Hartman is talking about is that talent, that capacity to bring things together that don't seem to come together, and out of that, build new things. And I would say a very simple example of that would be this, that if you think Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have nothing to do with each other, you haven't thought enough. They actually belong to the same political elites, the same economic classes. They have differences tactically. But in one sense, they're products of the economies that were produced in the 1980s, 1990s, the economy of real estate, the economy of lawyering, which Hillary Clinton was, and the economy that has this really high end where people are very credentialed, and then this other stuff, basically Starbucks, Dunkin' Donuts, au pairs, all the people basically doing all the work that these credential elites, these professionals and the ruling classes have, all these people basically taking care of their children, doing all kinds of things for them that they don't have to do so they can focus on their lives. And this is a fundamental contradiction of American capitalism. What is it? That the beautiful dreams and desires of the elites in this country are subsidized by the mass unmet collective needs of the many. What do I mean by that? Well, think about it. Go to a Whole Foods store, or go to a nice restaurant in any of the gentrifying sections or gentrified sections in the metropolitan centers throughout this country. And you'll go to a nice restaurant, you'll get a bill, maybe it's a romantic evening with your partner, and that bill basically has been subsidized by the people on the back doing the least remunerated work, getting the least salary, and they may be undocumented. They're probably from the global south, from Africa, Latin America, or Asia. And if they were paid a decent wage and given benefits, that bill that you have would be twice as expensive. So that's the contradiction of capitalism, that has this dream space, this sort of ideal space. And this is the phrase that I love the most about, that's been used a lot recently. It's called, "I'm living my best life." That's ideology, you know, in a nutshell. No one lives their best life if they're not living a virtuous life. And more importantly, there is no such thing as a best life. And so what that's saying is, I'm consuming or traveling or having all the benefits of this society, But all those benefits are subsidized by unmet mass collective needs of the basically laboring majorities of the society itself, right? And it's that contradiction, right? Need tied systemically to your desires for the beautiful life, for the best life possible. So what we do, social analysts, is we break that down. We say, how is it that if I go to a playground in Tribeca and I see all these white little children, that their nannies are from the West Indies, the Philippines, from South Asia, from Latin America, and that most of those nannies, or many of them, may be undocumented, and they're sending money to their home countries, to their children who are being taken care of by grandparents or aunties or what have you. So that beautiful life, that Sex in the City life that people live, it's really based upon this misery, this unmet collective needs. And at the heart of that is, I think, a fascist instinct that no matter what, I'm going to get mine. And if it means that you have to subsidize it, then fine. And remember, the poor are stigmatized in this society. The rich never are. But in fact, it's the poor, it's the working majority that subsidize and create the material circumstances for those lives, if you will, of the rich and famous. So my friends, we talked a little bit about the virtues, and I'm going to end with that quote from that ancient text. When we say that virtue is the order or the ordering of love, we refer to the end to which virtue is ordered, because in us, love is set in order by virtue. Who said that? Thomas Aquinas, believe it or not. Some old Dominican who wrote this huge book called the Summa. We'll go back to that later. And next week, we're going to talk about spiritual discernment. So have a wonderful week. And remember, by thinking hard, living hard, and loving hard, we're going to change this place.